It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Lauren Simonetti.
I'm Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Kat Timpf, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. From chickens to seals, then dairy cows, and now a person. The avian flu is spreading.
Limit the people who come to farms or on farms to those are necessary only. Those people who interact with the animals, you know, are necessary only type of situations.
I'm Chris Foster. James Patterson's thrillers and crime novels usually end with a bad guy stopped, the mystery solved. Not so, the stories in his new Fox Nation true crime series, Unsolved with James Patterson.
A lot of times the police haven't figured it out, and we watch television and we think the police, well, they're going to figure everything out. And it's not that easy. Sometimes the killers are very smart. Some of these killers, are out there for decades.
And I'm Dr. Rebecca Grant. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Last week, the USDA confirmed avian flu had been detected in dairy cows in Texas and Kansas. This week, Texas health officials confirmed a person contracted H5N1. The CDC says it's only the second time a human being's tested positive for that avian flu strain.
This individual was given Tamiflu and seems to be improving.
Chris Van Dusen with the Texas Department of State Health Services told Fox 7 in Austin the only symptom this person had was an eye infection after having contact with dairy cows. The CDC and county health officials say the risk of spreading this is low right now.
And it is extremely rare for this virus to be transmitted from one person to another. And the genetic testing that's happened so far doesn't show any changes in the virus.
Since February of 2022, more than 82 million chickens and other birds have been sickened by this avian flu. Phil Matos is the president of the California Poultry Federation and Northwest Chicken Council. He told KTVU Fox 2 in California.
What happens is you have to, they're euthanized humanely or they die, one or the other. And then we've got to clean up the ranches, and they're not allowed to put more birds on there for a month or two.
All of that has impacted egg and chicken prices. This virus has also along the way sickened and resulted in the deaths of thousands of seals. Now goats in Minnesota have been impacted as scientists and veterinarians watch to see how many more animals and possibly people this virus impacts.
For the dairy industry and for dairy cattle, this is just, we're still trying to figure out how the virus got here.
Dr. Mike Kleinheinz is a clinical associate professor of dairy cattle production at Texas A&M University.
And what its impact will be. And the reported case out of Texas of the human being exposed, and the reports that I've read and heard that this individual was involved in the dairy industry, so would have very close contact with dairy cows. And so that could be something to it, is their proximity to those animals.
Yeah, this person is only the second to ever contract avian flu of this strain, H5N1. Do other people who work with dairy cows, do they have to take different precautions now given what's happened to this individual? Or is it sort of business as usual for dairy farmers?
Well, for the dairy industry and for dairy farmers, the farmers and their employees, you know, they're always constantly looking for ways to improve. And so for something that's been available to all farm employees has been personal protective equipment. And so things like gloves, eye goggles, and things like that, especially if they're working in environments that are sometimes less than sanitary due to things like the manure and things like that. And so it's kind of business as usual, but you know, there is an extra step of making sure you're washing your hands and doing those proper things. And so the veterinarians and the health officials working with those dairies are getting that message out and kind of re-emphasizing the need for those things in the dairy industry.
So before a person got this strain, H5N1, we were told avian flu had moved on to infect dairy cows. That was last week. After what chicken farmers have gone through, what is the level of fear right now among dairy farmers or concern about what this could mean?
So obviously they're very concerned, you know, for this and what it's appearing to be in dairy farms and how it appears on dairy farms. It's a very high morbidity. So there's a lot of cows that get sick, but it's almost no mortality. So really the cows aren't dying from this. They just become sick. And really their illnesses are very nondescript and not very severe. So they just stop eating. Farmers are tracking their ruminations through kind of like a Fitbit, essentially. They're noticing those dropping off, and then their milk production falls off from where they should be, or they're compared to their peers where they should be. And so the concern for farmers is obviously their animals are getting sick. They're not producing milk like they should. And then now we have the added level of, is it infecting our employees or something like that? But the big concern for farmers is, their animals, aren't producing like they should be. They're not healthy like they know they should be. And they're just trying to figure out an answer. What can they do for those animals? And what is the next steps and the best steps? So what a lot of farms have started to do proactively is enhance their biosecurity. So limit the people who come to farms or on farms to those are necessary only. Those people who interact with the animals, are on necessary only type of situations. And so they're really enhancing those prevention measures between humans and their animals.
Yeah, that would make sense. You said earlier in the interview, we don't know where exactly this came from. There's always sort of an investigation, right? Or there's an attempt to find out, how did this go? How did this infect dairy cows specifically in Texas and Kansas? Do you know anything about that investigation? Would you imagine part of that is, hey, were any of these cows near chickens? I imagine they're not. Are these animals pretty spaced out from other animals that might have avian flu, like chicken populations?
Yes. So there, there is a space between, where cattle are housed and where, say, chickens are housed. There's really not very many chicken farms here in the Texas Panhandle. I can't think of any off the top of my head. Can't think about it. Unfortunately, we do have interaction because our cattle are, have outdoor access to wild bird populations. And so that's always an avenue or a risk that we have is those natural avian and species coming in, like starlings and things like that, that'll come into dairy farms. And so there's that risk of those animals maybe carrying that virus and contracting the disease from them.
Yeah.
But there is an active, the state health organizations, the USDA, several other producer allied organizations are working for, kind of an epidemiological approach as to how did it get here? How does it go farm to farm? How can we stop its spread essentially, or limit its spread between farms and among farm and then also within the farm?
Tell me more about what happens to the cows that get sick, because you were just referencing that they do produce less milk. We know that milk does not go into the supply of the milk that we drink. But what, right. what exactly happens to these cows? And do we know how, if a farmer has X number of cows, are they all infected, or is it just like a certain percentage of each farm's cows that are seem to be getting this? What do we know about, I guess, the illness?
So what we know is that this disease is relegated to older animals on farms. And so it's animals that have had one or two calves. So they're older animals, animals that are, in the dairy industry, we call past peak lactation. So an animal will peak in lactation about 90 days in milk. And then after that, their production slowly decreases over time. And it's cows that are beyond that peak that are also becoming affected by this. Hmm. Clinically, what cows are showing are, they're just not consuming as much feed. If their farmers are following this, they're not ruminating like they should be if they have the monitors on board on those animals. Our milk weights. So a lot of farms will take a daily milk weight. So every time a cow gets milked, it's recorded how much milk she produced. And those numbers are monitored. And those cows will go from being milking their normal amount of milk to milking, you know, under half of what they did the previous milking. So those are the what our farmers are seeing. So they're very nondescript, you know, they're not sick animals, but they are not what where they should be animals.
When a farmer notices that he's got a certain number of cows that appear sick, do they get separated out so that to try and like stop it from spreading, or is it too late by then?
So those farms do pull those animals out of their what are called their home pens and then put them into a hospital pen. So a special pen where animals that are sick go to. And so that's where they take them. And currently reports are about 10% or less of the herd dairies that are affected, about 10% of the cows milking actually become infected by this. So it's still a small percent of the herd that becomes affected.
Do you think given that number then, could this eventually impact the country's milk supply, or would this have to be actually a much bigger problem?
So it will, there probably could be some impacts on the milk supply, and that's just because of the amount of milk being produced is lower. And so there's those issues that can go into it. So in the Panhandle, we have a lot of larger farms, and so the milk supply in a regional area will be a lot lower. And so we'll probably have to rely on milk from an outside source to fill our production capacities, and hopefully these animals will come back into milk and start producing where they should be. But there is a risk that the national milk supply will be lower than what it was, the production wise.
That means higher cost, doesn't it? And just to be clear, like you said, there's no antivirals for cows, or at least not in this case, right? So we just have to hope that they heal. You said that none of them are dying, right? So they're sick and hopefully going to get better.
Reports from early herds that were infected by this early on in this disease outbreak, a lot of the cows are starting to recover and starting to come back to their normal previous milk production and returning back to where they were prior to being what is presumed to be affected with this virus.
Mm-hmm. And finally, then, I understand this is just one of many stresses right now, actually, for dairy farms, right? There were wildfires recently that have killed some dairy cattle in that Panhandle region known as cattle country. And now I'm reading about some farmers looking into antibiotics to treat mastitis. I'm not sure how widespread that is right now, but how big a deal is all of this to dairy farmers? It seems like one hit after another.
Yeah, it's obviously a very stressful time for the dairy industry and dairy farmers in the Texas Panhandle. Not knowing, how this is being spread adds to that angst. If you can't control it, control what you can? And so that is something that does add to it. And then, obviously the recent wildfires in our area and how that impacted the cattle producers in the area. And so that's just one more thing on top of what has been kind of lower milk production prices and a hard economic industry right now kind of creates a little more angst for them, unfortunately.
Professor and Dr. Mike Klenhans, thank you so much for your time.
You're most welcome.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
I'm Dana Perino. Join me for my podcast, Perino on Politics. Every Monday, I'm going to talk to people I trust in politics as they tell me what they're seeing and thinking in the 2024 election cycle.
When it comes to campaign cash, President Biden is saying, show me the money. But will it help him come November? This week, I'm joined by the president and CEO of Squared Communications, Michael Meehan, for a look at the challenges ahead for the Biden campaign. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.
This is Dr. Rebecca Grant with your Fox News commentary coming up.
James Patterson is one of the most popular authors literally ever since the invention of the printing press, selling hundreds of millions of books, thrillers, romance novels, nonfiction, young adult and children's books, just about everything but maybe cookbooks, poetry, and instruction manuals. His best-selling series include the Alex Cross, Women's Murder Club, and Michael Bennett books. His latest novel is the legal mystery Number One Lawyer. He's also hosting a new three-part true crime series streaming on Fox Nation.
Who's willing to come forward and tell us what happened to this man?
It's unusual to have somebody disappear seemingly without any trace.
They say there's no such thing as a perfect murder.
We need to know what happened.
She was afraid for her life, and her life was taken.
Series available now is called Unsolved with James Patterson.
They went out and they found these jaw-dropping stories, true crime stories, which a lot of people love. I'm one of them.
He also gets in front of the camera this time as the show's narrator.
One of them is this woman in Louisiana. Basically, her home was a fortress. She had cameras and a lot of weapons. And then she was found murdered inside the house, but there was no film of anything on the cameras. So with all of that protection that she had, nobody could figure out, you know, how she was actually murdered inside her house, which is a cool unsolved story. And we're also encouraging people who are watching the series to call in if they have ideas or if they know things about the stories. Second case was one of the most popular guys in San Francisco. He's really famous for taking in people into his house, helping people. And he's really beloved. And they found out he was murdered in his house, but they couldn't find the body, but the body was inside the house somewhere. So that's like one of these great, fascinating, who done it, why done it, where is the body stories, which is a cool one.
We might as well talk a little bit about these cases, as we literally can't spoil them. So the first case, Nanette Krentel, shot in the head, 2017. Are there doubts about her husband having been cleared?
Mrs. Krentel, I don't think anybody's been cleared. I mean, that's one of the tricks. The suspects are still all out there. And that's one of the things that makes the case is particularly interesting. And we interview some of the people, during the show who are suspects. The police are still scratching their head. There's still a lot of leads. They just haven't solved it. And this notion of with all the protection that she had, and it wasn't atypical of that area. A lot of the homes, fairly nice homes around there, and several of them had a lot of protection. You know, as you know, a lot of people, and certainly a lot of states, there are a lot of guns. She had a lot of guns, and she did have cameras, and so it's just a dazzler of a case.
And then the guy in San Francisco, Brian Egg, whatever happened to him was pretty gruesome. He was kind of known for helping people out and taking people in, and that's obviously where the police you'd think would go and where your mind would go. There were some arrests, but never charges.
Here, once again, a lot of suspects, a lot of people questioned by the police, but nothing that led to any kind of conviction. So the killer is still out there. And in the case of Brian Egg's situation, they knew or they really suspected that the body was somewhere in his house. And there were a lot of shenanigans that took place at the house. People came in and cleaned it out. People took furniture and stuff out of the house. They had a lot of this on video. So these people were all suspects, and yet no arrests.
In that last case, Elizabeth Salgado, sad story. She just moved before she was last seen. She moved from Mexico to Utah to study. Last seen leaving class, right. 2015. They found her skeletal remains 3 years later. And, you know, you could say, well, it's a long walk home. Maybe she fell, had some kind of medical thing on a trail, but where they found her, she just wouldn't have been walking.
Yeah. I mean, Liz, she moved from Mexico to Utah, very religious young woman. And they couldn't find the body for quite a while. And eventually, and they didn't know, you know, what had happened. She left somewhere and was walking home. They thought maybe she, had fallen into or had some kind of medical emergency. So for quite a while, they didn't know where she was. Eventually, they found the body in a canyon. A lot of suspects once again. And, this penny, by the body and whoever left it, presumably the killer, was leaving it as some kind of clue. And You know, once again, people out in the area may have some theories about it. And, you know, we're open for business in terms of solving some of these unsolved murders.
Look, you've obviously spent a lot of time over the decades thinking out the puzzles of, you know, so-called perfect murders, plotting them out. Do you think in real life, more people who get away with it or have gotten away with it so far are smart or they're lucky or there's incompetence with the investigation?
You know, I mean, one of the things that draws people to my books and a lot of books like it is they want closure. They want things to be solved. In the case of this Fox Nation, it's totally different because the cases aren't solved. In almost all of the cases that I write about in terms of novels, we usually wind up with a solution. We usually solve them in some way. I can't remember now. I think there are a couple where I sort of left it dangling at the end. I'm now writing a book about with Vicki Ward about the Idaho murders, and they certainly have a very strong suspect there. They have Kohlberg in jail, but we'll see where that goes. But I think, you know, people, you know, they do want closure, but the reality of it is a lot of times the police haven't figured it out. And we watch television and we think the police, well, they're going to figure everything out. And it's not that easy. Sometimes the killers are very smart. Some of these killers, you know, are out there for decades. Some of the serial killers, in some cases, you know, there are murders that have happened and people don't have a clue that it was one person that committed the murders, the same person. And I think that's why, I mean, it's good for me in the sense of, you know, I've sold a lot of books because people love these mystery stories, these suspense stories. You keep them on the edge of their seats. They want to know what happened. They want to know what happened. And the key to suspense in terms of writing books like this is you plant the seed, you put the hook in there, and they just want to know. They want to know the answer. They want to know what the solution is.
Yeah.
But with Unsolved, we're not telling them. We're not going to tell them. We're just going to give them a whole lot of clues, and the clues are, you know, very interesting stuff. All of the storytelling is good in Unsolved.
I mean, I just started your new novel, your latest novel, Number One Lawyer. Sort of a classic, yeah. Sort of a classic character, classic premise. Don't spoil it for me. Don't spoil it for anyone. But just, you know, tell people who this guy's about.
Well, the Number One Lawyer. First of all, I'm a total junkie for lawyer stories and murder trials. I love them. What I wanted to do there was to do something that would rival the stuff that I've really loved in the past. And in this case, you have a really, really popular lawyer. Really successful lawyer, he's never lost a case down in Mississippi. He has to go to court. And the reason he has to go to court is he's been accused of murdering his wife in cold blood. There's a fair amount of evidence. And he decides he's against a lot of advice that he's going to defend himself. And I love that scenario. It's just, it's kind of irresistible for anybody who loves drama and suspense and melodrama. Which I love as well, you know, so that's and there are a lot of elements obviously to it. I like doing it in Mississippi. It's right on the Gulf, he actually at one point has to get out of the law for a while, and he becomes a lifeguard on the beaches in Biloxi, which is interesting. And then he goes back into being a lawyer again. To solve cases. And, you know, I love the whole scenario. The whole story of it is kind of, and, you know, when I start one of these novels, I always hope they're going to turn out well, and sometimes not so much. But this one turned out really well, Number One Lawyer. It's really, nobody's going to be disappointed with it, I don't think.
Well, it's already, you know, as usual, up there on the bestseller list. So this is, yeah. What, your third book? That one, you mentioned Vicki Ward, the Utah book. This one is with Nancy Allen, right? It's your third book,
yeah.
With her?
I lose track. But yeah, we did. It's for sure two. Juror Number Three, which we're taking to film at this stage, and then I suspect Number One Lawyer will get option two. Yeah, and the thing with Nancy, she's great. She's a lawyer in Missouri. You know, did murder. You know, was a lawyer on murder trials. She taught. Law in college as well. So she's good in terms of keeping me honest so that pretty much everything that happens here is pretty accurate.
Look, I think of novel writing as such this solitary thing, and that's how a lot of novelists talk about it.
As a
lonely thing. But you do a ton of collaborations. You clearly must like working stories out with other people.
People look at it like it's a bad thing. Collaboration is a good thing. Pretty much all television shows are collaborations. They'll have anywhere from 6 to 10 writers in the writer's room, and they collaborate. We have coming up, we have the Alice Cross series on Amazon, and, you know, 6 writers in a writer's room collaborating. You know, if we're ever going to sort of save the planet, it's going to be because we learn to collaborate. So, you know, the collaborations are all different, and they keep me, fascinated by every project.
Well, another collaboration, Unsolved, the new series streaming on Fox Nation, 3 episodes. You can watch them now. The new book is Number One Lawyer. Jim, it's good to talk to you again. Thanks a lot. James Patterson.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much.
And in other news,
I'm Gianna Gelosi. As man's best friend gets older, their aging brains shrink and they can suffer memory and thinking problems like older humans do. But a new study from the Journal of Neuroscience shows that, also like humans, playtime and social activities can help preserve their brain function. For the study, researchers tracked the brain health of 43 6-year-old beagles, including 36 females and 7 males, for 3 years as part of the study involving 2 potential drugs for Alzheimer's disease. All dogs received daily exercise, play with a rotating set of toys, and socialization. They were also allowed to play for a half hour each day in male-only or female-only groups. Beagles assigned to receive the brain drugs didn't do any better or worse than the control group that only received social enrichment, but all dogs appeared to benefit from playtime and social activities. Researchers explain that these kinds of activities can increase healthy blood flow to the brain and could even prompt the growth of brain cells. Researchers say they will continue to follow up with the dogs as they continue to age. For the Fox News Rundown, I'm Gianna Gelosi.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. On September 2nd, 1982, 15-year-old Karen Stitt never made it home from her bus stop in Sunnyvale, California. Her body was found the next morning, raped and stabbed 59 times. This week, I'm joined by Sunnyvale Detective Matt Hutchison as he details the creative investigative journey he took to arrest the suspect 40 years later. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.
Subscribe to this podcast at FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Dr. Rebecca Grant.
What's on your mind?
According to the newly released budget, the Pentagon wants to slow down America's aircraft carriers. The Navy has a budget plan for new aircraft carriers that can launch drones, carry lasers, and face down China. But the Biden budget took out so much money that the whole aircraft carrier plan may fall apart. I can't remember when I've seen such a policy and reality mismatch. Deterrence in 2 major combat theaters is resting on these 100,000-ton ships. So it's astonishing that the Navy's fiscal year 2025 budget just sent to Congress is going to slow down new Navy aircraft carriers by taking away shipbuilding funds for 2 years. China's newest aircraft carrier, the Fujian, is bigger and a technological leap ahead. The Fujian started dead load catapult testing last November. China's serious about launching aircraft carriers to compete with U.S. designs. Their aircraft carriers are still not nuclear powered and overall not as capable as the Ford class, but they can cause plenty of trouble, especially for allies. If China keeps producing the Fujian class, Chinese carriers could lock out the U.S. and allies from the Strait of Malacca to the Sea of Japan. So this carrier slip is also damaging because it impacts our new carriers. Believe me, these are the carriers you want the Navy to buy. The Ford's electromagnetic catapults finesse the launch with gradually increasing power and vary the speed for launching lighter airframes, such as drones. Pilots do say it's strange not to see the steam wafting up. However, the USS Ford generated over 10,000 sorties in 239 days underway with the new catapults. future aircraft carriers in 2040 in a heavy electromagnetic spectrum threat environment have many more options for the types of aircraft flying off their decks. But only if the Navy buys the carriers now. Law mandates at least 11 operational aircraft carriers, and the Navy's always said they'd prefer 12. Buying an aircraft carrier every 6 or 7 years is not economical, obviously. Worse, it's probably not feasible. The precious workforce of American men and women who build carriers cannot stand around, and they may drift off to other programs which have money. The Navy's own charts show the result is a fall to 10, then 9 aircraft carriers in the next decades. No carriers, no agile deterrence. China's Navy is already bigger than ours. The advanced aircraft carriers are key to America's military edge that protects our way of life. This is not the moment to let China sneak ahead. I'm Rebecca Grant for Fox News.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.